I'm trying to get a little bit of new guys, old guys, you know, sometimes. I definitely don't like standing between a man and his meal. It's an unpopular position. You know, we've talked a lot. I've talked to guys about new guys, old guys, you know, sometimes people have been around a while, people that are new, how to carry the message. And to me, really, what is an amazingly powerful message sometimes is to be able to talk to a guy that's been around for a while and not feeling it. You know, I work a lot with guys. When I had my biggest spiritual awakening at 17 years, I hear it a lot. Fred and I talked about it last night. He was saying at 17 years, he was in a dark spot. And there's a lot of, we're going to talk some about this second surrender when we get into the third step. But I've had guys, you know, on page 152, it talks about this jumping off place. And it says, at a certain point, or it says, he cannot picture life without alcohol. And then it goes on to say, someday he'll be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. And that's the way I found myself for a long time. That's with that jumping off. It says, that he'll, then it says, well, let me finish it. It says, then he will know loneliness such as few do. He'll be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. That's what brought me into AA. But I meet a lot of guys that have been around. When I always say, you know, for the new guy, I'm glad you're here, and I hope you'll come back and become a part of our lives and everything. But I think there's a lot of message out there for the new guy. But sometimes I'm talking to the guy that's been around a while, 3 years, 5 years, 15, 25 years. And, you know, the book talks about the most satisfactory years of our existence lie ahead of us, and not all of us are feeling that. You know, when I go to the big meetings, I like to look around, and here's a tool I use at the big meetings. You know how we're funny and we say stuff and people are laughing and everything. And when I feel the whole room burst out into laughter, that's when I like to go to work. I like to look around the room, and because not everybody's laughing, you know, and there's a guy in there that doesn't think a damn thing is funny, you know, and that's the guy that I'm looking for. Sometimes I go, where you at? You know, how's it going? And that sort of thing, because the only thing darker than that jumping off place of knowing I can't keep getting loaded the way I'm getting loaded, and I can't imagine not getting loaded at all. The only thing darker than that is when it's a guy that has been around AA for a while, drunk or sober, maybe he relapsed or he didn't, but he's thinking, I can't keep drinking the way I'm, I know I can't drink, I can't not drink, and the only thing that you're saying works for me, works for a guy like me, doesn't work for me. That's a dark spot. That's when suicide starts looking like an option to people who've never considered it before, you know. And to be able to tell that guy that there's a different level of this deal available is a huge message. And I just love doing it, man, because we're going to talk about it a little bit. I want to roll into step three. I hope I got enough. Well, I'm not going to get very far into it. We'll probably have to do the session after lunch too. But you know, with that jumping off place, all I like to say about step two, you know, really, the chapter We Agnostics is a whole lot about setting aside prejudice and old ideas and just the set-aside prayer concept and being willing to look at where did my ideas come from and, you know, how are they driving me, and am I willing to, you know, look for possibly a new experience, you know, and there's stuff in here. I used to think that in order to take step two, let's say that this is a graph right here on this thing, and zero is over here, meaning there is no such thing as any power greater than myself. It's a big hoax, and there's nothing to it at all. That's zero. And over here is 100, meaning absolute God consciousness. Had lunch with him yesterday. You know, I walk hand in hand with the Creator on a daily basis. You know, that would be 100. And I used to think that in order to take step two, that I had to get all the way over to 100. And over again, reading in the book, all it's saying is, are you willing to believe that possibly there might be something to the right of zero? Is it possible? It says on that cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. So that's, I got to, you know, you got to move the guy beyond that. You know, a friend of mine said when he gets a real hard head, sometimes he'll go, well, let me ask you this. Can you, because, you know, drunks, I can't, tell you what I believe in when I show up here, but I can talk a long time about what I don't believe in, you know, and that's why Abby hit Bill with that. Well, then why don't you choose your own concept of God? And Bill said that statement hit me hard because he didn't have an answer for it. You know, he was ready to talk about what he didn't believe in, but when he said just choose your own concept of a power, he's like, you know, he said it melted away. The scales of prejudice fell from his eyes and that sort of thing. You know, so we try to move a guy into that. But I just want to hit on a couple of things in there. There's a thing on page 28. That talks about form a relationship upon simple and understandable terms. And then on 29, it says, further on, I love, this is one of the promises in the book. Further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recovered. Each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. And it goes on and on, but just hitting on a couple of high points. I love this line on 34. Where it says, for those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. And this is one of my favorite lines. It says, we are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. You know, I guess it's an important question to ask. You know, but I love these stories. And More About Alcoholism deals a lot with the mental conditions that precede that first drink. The one is about the mental obsession and what happens right before I take that first drink. And they're pounding this stuff in, you know, as if it's like if the physical allergy and the mental obsession didn't scare me enough, then you also got this mental blank spot that can just creep up on you, you know, at any time. But I love Fred. I don't have a lot of time to spend on Fred this morning, but I do love, you know, he's the guy that's the end of a perfect day. Everybody's going to love him. You know, his family's got a great family and all this stuff, and he says he's the one that's crossing the threshold to the dining room and just decides maybe a cocktail would be good with dinner, you know, and then he has one and he says, I went for a walk after dinner. I'm like, I bet that was a really short walk, you know. Just, you know, out and back to the bar, you know. But he has highballs and all that. He winds up flat on his back in the hospital again. And they come back to see him again. The guys from AA come back to see him. They'd already broken down to him what it meant to be an alcoholic. And he says, you know, what you told me about he says, you know, what you had told me they prophesied that if I had an alcoholic mind the time and place would come I'd drink again. And I wouldn't raise well that just that did happen, for what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. And then it says two of the members came to him, and it says they asked if he thought he was alcoholic and if he was really licked this time. And it says they piled on me heaps of evidence to the effect that an alcoholic mentality such as I exhibited in Washington was a hopeless condition. They cited cases out of their own experience by the dozen. And why would they do that? It says, once again, it says, this process snuffed out the last flicker of conviction that I could do the job myself. Damn. You know, but the reason I fell in love with Fred is because in the next paragraph, he says, they outline the spiritual answer and the program of action, which 100 of them had followed. Though, you know, he goes, their proposals were not intellectually hard to swallow. This is where I love the man. But the program of action, though entirely sensible, was pretty drastic. You know? Do you love this guy? You know, I mean, he's flat on his back. We come talk to him. He goes out. He crashes and burns again. He's back in the hospital. They come in and he goes, yeah, I got it just like that. He goes, but God dang, no. You know, I mean, that's what I'm going to talk about. I have to be driven by that step one experience into all this work. On 44 is one of the tests for alcoholism. Here it says, we hope we've made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. Here's one question. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. And then it says, if that be the case, You may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And I've underlined in my book, and I wrote, only? You know, only a spiritual experience will conquer. That's where I find myself in this deal. You know, lack of power was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves. Obviously, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. And over on 47 is what we call the second step question. Says we needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Well, I do like this line above here where it says, do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. At the start, this was all we needed to commence spiritual growth. There's still spiritual terms that trigger a reaction in me. Mark used to talk a lot about the carpenter. And one time I said, you know, Mark, it's funny, when you say the carpenter, I don't want to physically attack you. And he said, well, that's why I say it. You know, it gets around that prejudice. It gets around that old, and I have to ask myself, where does that reaction come from? There's terms like sin and, you know, where I go, you know, and still, I mean, I'm all about God. I'm working on God consciousness all the time, but there are times where people will come up and go, do you believe in God? And I'm like, we better have a conversation about that. You know, you know, it triggers a reaction in me. And the chapter We Agnostics is a whole lot about trying to set aside those ideas. Because Bill and I were talking about this on the way up yesterday. It's funny, growing up in that Baptist church, I formed most of my ideas about God by the time I was 12 years old. And I carried those beliefs into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous when I showed up here. And it's kind of funny when you think about it. Can you imagine if you come in here and you decide, you know, I'm going to set out on a spiritual path. I'm going to try to become closer to this power and learn about God. I'm going to find a 12-year-old and ask him some questions, you know. You know, how much is it? But that's what I carried in here for a long time. Do I now believe? Here's the second step question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as a man can say he does believe or is willing to believe, we ensure him he's on his way. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. Well, I'm going to roll over to page 52. These spiritual bedevilments, I've never heard of them for a long time. And although I'm driven by this step one experience now, at 28 years sober, I know that the drink is available to me. I've seen people do it. But what seems to drive me into the work these days are these bedevilments. When I talk about that flat period of sobriety between when I was in that marriage with the New York woman, you know, I spent a lot of time in these bedevilments, and these are available in sobriety, and I really don't want to go back to living this way. And listen to the way it describes it. It says, we were having trouble with our personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. I used to hang my hat on that one because I could make money. I was still making money. But then somebody goes, well, are you happy and satisfied at work? And you're like, damn, you're going to take that one from me too. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution to these bedevilments more important than real lunar flight? There are some words that Bill uses over and over in the book. That the more I study the book, themes and words that seemed important to Bill start popping up to me. And one of the ones I've been looking at in the past few years is this word basis and basic and basically. Bill used it a lot right in the book. And if you looked at, we use, at my home group, we use a 1936 Webster's Dictionary. And while we're studying the book, if you come across a word, you can just call it out and we'll look it up, you know, to see what it means or what it meant at the time they were writing the book, because some words have changed in meaning between the 30s and now. Meditation is a big one. Brainstorm is another one. You know, brainstorm, I thought it meant, you know, coming up with a bright idea. That's the way Walt Disney did it. He talked about brainstorm. But if you look it up in that old dictionary, it says a sudden and violent mental outburst. You know, so, a brain, when it says they're not for us, I mean, that's rage. You know, a brainstorm is not the little light bulb over my head, you know, but a lot of words like that. And you know, when I looked up basis, it said the fundamental idea of something or the underlying foundation of something. You know, when so Bill talks about that word a lot. He says, you know, was not a basic solution to these bedevilments more important. And he goes on to talk about that. Well, I'm going to go right over to how it works, page 58. When I talked about the new experience that I had in the steps in this thing, I'm actually going to, we read this how it works in so many meetings. And when it comes down to this A, B, and C at the end, it says, A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. Is that your situation? You know, is that where you find? B, that probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. And that's where, for some reason, around the country, people have started chanting like a bunch of kids at summer camp. When they get to this line, you know, God could and would if he were sought. And I'd just like to take a little second to talk about the chanting, personally, because it drives me crazy. But it comes out of the treatment center environment, and people, you know, start to chant things and do things. And I just want to say, I'm not going to say I hate you if you do it. I'm just saying you don't have to do it. It's optional, you know. I mean, when I came into AA, they would say, keep coming back. You know, seemed a little silly, but okay, keep coming back, you know. And then it was, keep coming back, it works. And then it was, keep coming back, it works if you work it and you're worth it, so work it. You know, and I'm like, oh, for God's sake, you know. I mean, you know, and I always picture the newcomer going, oh, God, I really want to stop drinking whiskey, but I mean, do I really have to do this whole shave and a haircut, two bits, you know, you know, because they start, now it's, you know, God could and would if he were sought. And then principles before personalities. And I noticed they didn't do it at that meeting we went to the other night. But I just want to say it's optional, you know. You know, I mean, it turns out amen is a really kick-ass way to end a prayer. You know, I mean, people have been doing it for a long time. I mean, We're the only group of people that thinks we got to put a little flavor on the end of the Lord's Prayer. You know, it's like, I think I can do this a little cooler than Jesus did it. You know, I'm just saying, it's optional. I'm a little, but it's funny when we get to that. See, okay, it says, you know what the next line is? It says, being convinced. We were at step three. Being convinced of what? A, B, and C. So if being convinced of A, B, and C puts me at step three, A, B, and C must do a pretty good job of summing up one and two. A, that I'm an alcoholic and I can't manage my own life. By now, hopefully the guy knows what we're talking about. On page 30, it says the thing about we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. It was the first step in recovery. If I'm going to fully concede, I need to know what it means to be an alcoholic. By now it says, A, that I'm alcoholic and cannot manage my own life. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. Then he goes on, and here's the thing. My first pass through the steps, we went right from C, that God could and would if he were sought, to then let's get you down on your knees and do the third step prayer and get you right in inventory. We went right from, do you believe that there could, you know, are you alcoholic? Yes. Do you believe there might be a power? Yes. Well, then let's do the third step prayer and get you right in inventory. And what happened was I missed this entire body of work between pages 60 and 63. And like I talked about last night, it's really not that important. It's just the root of my problem, you know, and the basis of my recovery for the rest of my life, you know. So what was my new experience with this? I'm reading this one day, and it says, Being convinced we were at step three. I was talking to Bob about this earlier. It says, which is, we decided to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood him. Now, remember back on page 29, it promised me clear-cut directions. When it says, I'm going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, it asks what I think are fair questions for the new guy to ask. What do you mean by that? And what do you want me to do? You know, if you're telling me I got to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, I don't get it. What do you mean by that? And what do I do? Now, here's where it blew me out of the water. I'm reading this. It's at about 15, 16, 17 years sober. I can't remember. And it says, the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. What? I'll never forget looking at that line and going, good grief. Not only have I never been convinced of that, that line has never touched me. And if you followed me around, I always say, if you want to see what I believe, listen to what comes out of my mouth. Watch my feet. Follow me around and see what, you know, do I demonstrate the stuff that we're talking about? And if you followed me around in those years of sobriety, it would have been clear that this was not a guy convinced that his life run on self-will could hardly be a success. It would really be more obvious, this is a guy that thinks self-will will do it. You know? And I didn't know what that means. But it says, on that basis, there's that word basis again, where the underlying principle of my life is that I'm running this deal, that I got this. It says, on that basis, I'm almost always in collision with something or somebody. You know, when it said, just what do we mean by that and what do we do? It's going to spend the next two pages talking about what we mean. And then it's going to shift over to what we do. And I'm going to try to hit this in 30 minutes. But it says, on the basis of self-will, I'm almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though my motives are good. Damn. You know, I mean, all I want to talk to you about when there's a jackpot is what my motives were. I wasn't trying to call. You ever try to do something nice for your AA group and you look up and everybody's pissed off and you're like, I wasn't trying to make any. I thought it was a good idea to rearrange the furniture, you know, or something, you know. And you know, and I had these great motives. When, you know, and then it goes on to say, most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the orchestra. I didn't understand that for a long time. Why is this guy a problem? Because he's just an actor, right? He's not the director. He's not supposed to be arranging the lights and the ballet and the orchestra and that sort of thing. His job is stand on the X and say your lines, you know. But, you know, you give me that job, though, and you go, okay, here's the deal, Charlie. You're a speaking extra in this. You're going to stand right here, and Julia Roberts is going to come in here, and she's going to walk over here, and George Clooney's going to be right over here. And your job when she comes through is to say, could I get you something to drink? Ready on the set? Action. In she walks, and I go, Hold up, cut. I got to say something here. This is really not, I don't like the way this is going. I don't think these guys should be standing over here. It's too bright in that door. She should come in that door, and she said, I need more lines. In fact, we don't even really need George Clooney. You know, just send her to me, you know, and I don't like the name of this movie very much either, you know. And, you know, and the director's over there going, who is this guy? You know, I mean, because I'm just supposed to be an actor, right? You see how? And then it goes on. Now, here we get into this delusion that it talks about. You know, the book, you hear people saying that this is a disease of denial. It never talks about denial in the book. It talks about delusion. And a delusion is a lie that I'm telling myself. And I mean, it feels like common sense. I mean, it's just like, I don't know about you guys, but when I get in delusion, God sounds a lot like me. And it says, if his arrangements would only stay put, here's the delusion. If only people would do as I wish, the show would be great. Right? It's not selfish. This is, I'm trying to create a little Charlie-topia here, you know, where everybody's happy. And it says, the show would be great. Everybody, including me, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. Right? How can that be selfish? And it says, here's what I call the toolkit of self-will. It says, in trying to make these arrangements, our actor may be sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing, right? Unless what? Unless that ain't working, right? And then it says, on the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as is with most humans, he's more likely to have varied traits. This toolkit of self-will, I always picture this guy that's kind of juking, you know, and it's like, you know, trying to get things to go my way. But it's like, I'm going to be nice over here. And I mean, like this guy, I can yell at and get him to do what I want. I can, you know, bull rush this guy. Now, Tom won't take care of it. He won't take that shit. So he's going to get nice, moderate. You know, I'm going to go, God dang, man, I wish I had more friends like you. You know, I mean, you're the one guy that understands what I'm trying to do around here, you know. And thank God I got you, you know. You know, but it's all me trying to get things to go the way I want them to go. And then it says, what usually happens? The show doesn't come off very well. I start thinking life doesn't treat me right. I know this doesn't apply to any of you guys in your sober lives today, but it says he decides to exert himself more. On the next occasion, he's either more demanding or more gracious, as the case may be. And it says, still the play doesn't suit me. Admitting I might be somewhat at fault. I'm sure other people are more to blame, right? In a beef, if you let me talk about my part and your part, you know, my part is going to be about that big, you know. And I think I'm being pretty generous by admitting that. You know, your part is the rest of, you know, but it says, admitting I may be somewhat at fault, I'm sure others are more to blame. And it goes on to say, remember, now we're still talking about what we mean, right? Remember, it said, what do we mean by that? And what do we do? We're still talking about what we mean. And it says, I become, and it's always in this order, angry, indignant, self-pity, angry. I cannot believe these people are not going to cooperate with me. You know, after all, I'm trying to create utopia here for me and everybody else. And then it says indignant. I can't believe after everything I've tried to do for this AA group, they're going to treat me like this. You know, and then the last stage is self-pity. What's the use? God Almighty, I'm surrounded by assholes. You know, I can't work with these people. You know, and this is not this week, next week. It's like boom, boom, boom. I'm angry. I'm indignant. Self-pity. It's always in that order. And it says, what is his basic trouble? There's that word basic again. Is he not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? What? And you go, see, when we talk about that, it's different when I screw up than when you screw up. Because it's very different. Because when I screw up, I've got this funnel that I've built out of my motives, which are always sterling. Mm-hmm. Right? And then the other side of it is this delusion I have that if everybody would do like I say, we'd have all been fine. You know, if I could just get everybody to act right, this thing would be fine. You know, so I've got good motives and I'm just trying to make things happen, but I couldn't get everybody. And so when I take my actions and run them through this funnel, when they come out the bottom, the worst I'm ever going to give myself when I'm grading my own papers is about an A minus. Right? Now, when you screw up, it's an outrage and I demand justice, you know. But when I screw up, I got a story to go with it, and I'm going to talk to you about my motives and what I was trying to do, and I wasn't trying to do that and that sort of thing. And it says, is he not a victim of the delusion? Now, a victim means tricked or duped by this delusion I have, this delusion that I can rest, which is the same root word as wrestle, to seize by force. That I can seize satisfaction and happiness from this world if I can just manage well. And I'm out there in sobriety managing my ass off, and I can't get things to go well. It feels like if everybody would just do like I say, we'd all be happy, right? And I can't get everybody to act right, you know? And it says, and isn't it evident to the rest of the players? If we're in this play and all of a sudden one guy's trying to get all the lines and all the attention and everything, I'm going to see what's going on. And what am I going to do? It says, and don't his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show. Am I not, even in my best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony? Now it goes, this is where I go with my sponsees all the time. You know, when I say I skipped this for a long time, now I got sponsees that are going, oh no, I got a sponsor that's only read 3 pages out of the big book. You know, because this is all we, and this is where we always go is, you know, producer of confusion rather than harmony. Where'd you set the ball rolling? Where'd you make decisions based on self? It goes down here and it says, our actor is self-centered. Egocentric, self, ego, but I'm self-centered. Now, when I used to hear selfish and self-centered, I thought you meant stingy and conceited, right? It's not that I think too much of myself or too little of myself. I just think about me too often. All I think about is me. And me, and me, and how's this going to affect me, and where's mine, and how's, you know, and am I getting cut out of this deal, and that sort of thing. You know, like the guy about Vegas, when I said I was in Vegas with me, and the level of self that I walk around with, I am completely blind to, right? But I'm always thinking about me. And on the top of the next page, this is heavy. We're still talking about, Bob, we're still talking about what we mean. When you say what we mean and what do we do, it's selfishness. Self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles, right? Up to now, I've been trimming the branches of my troubles. You know, it's the bank account, it's the girlfriend, it's the job. But the root of the problem the whole time has been selfishness and self-centeredness. I've said for a long time that the book takes a big right turn on page 60, and I missed it for 17 years. I'm more out there working a program like the problem is alcohol, and it never was. Chuck Chamberlain used to tell a story about a guy that was afraid of dogs. And when he looked in his history, he'd been a neighborhood dog had bit him. And he said, but when he looked at it even further, he had been chasing this little neighborhood girl across her yard when her dog came out and bit him. And he said, all my life I'd been running from dogs and chasing women, and dogs never were my problem. You know? That's the same thing I was doing in alcoholism and in AA. I was working a program like the problem was alcohol. And it says in here that, that alcohol never was the problem. Alcohol was the only thing I ever found that would seize, that would ease the discomfort of living a life based completely on selfishness and self-centeredness. And that's what I really want to talk about now, and we're going to talk about it in the session after the break. You know, it's a selfishness driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. That word driven is powerful. When I'm driven, I'm not choosing to act that way. I'm driven by fear. I'm driven by self-delusion. Mark used to talk about it's like a limousine pulls up and I hop in the back and the driver says, hello, my name's Fear. I'll be driving you today. I can't tell you where you're going or how it's going to turn out, you know, But I mean, when I'm driven, I mean, I have some unflattering stories to tell about myself, but I'm in sobriety and I broke up with the second chick, the one with the second child support payment and all that. And she was younger than me. So, you know, that period when you're driving by their place, you know, to see if there's another car in the driveway, is there a lower feeling in the world, you know, than going by? Well, it's not enough this day to just see if there's another, because she lives in an apartment, so I got to go by and see if Swingin' Richard's up in the apartment with her, and it turns out, though, that she lives on a second-story apartment, so before I know what's happening, I am up in a tree. Looking in this sliding glass door to see if there's somebody in there. And sure enough, there was. And then the next thing, the reason I tell this story is I didn't choose to climb up in that tree. I was driven by fear and self-delusion and self-seeking and self-pity. You know, and next thing you know, I'm up and she comes out on the patio to smoke a cigarette. And it's like this, it's like, you know, this time of year, and I'm wearing jeans and a white t-shirt and I'm going, she didn't see me, but I'm in this tree going, and in my mind I'm thinking, how did this happen? You know, I mean, that's what we're talking about, driven. You know, the 150 texts, You know, or did he ever say, I'm not going to say this, but, driven by this stuff. Driven means I'm not choosing to act this way. I'm driven by this stuff. And it says, driven by these things, I step on people's toes and they retaliate. Of course they do. Sometimes they hurt me, seemingly without provocation, right? I didn't do nothing. They just went off on me, you know? And it says, but invariably, invariably means more than half the time. We invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. Now, this is one of the biggest promises in the big book. It says, so our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. Why would that be a promise? Because the good news in that is that it ain't them. Because if it's them, I'm cooked, right? If my problems are of y'all's making, the only way I'm going to be okay is if I can get, this is the plural form of y'all, all y'all, to act right. If my problems are of y'all's making, the only way I'm going to be okay is if I can get everybody to act right. But if my problems are basically of my own making, then me and this power that I'm getting in touch with as a result of this work have a chance of working it out. That's the good news of this thing. And it says, my problems arise out of myself. And the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot. And I remember hearing that and going, I'm not an extreme example of self-will run riot, you know? And then I love the rest of the line. It says, though he usually doesn't think so. You know? And you know, the reason I don't think so is because of these motives and this delusion. You know, that things could have been different, you know, if y'all had just acted right. You know, that's why you always get the story when I screw up. I want to tell you the story that goes with it. And so it goes on. Now, I love to tell a story about that. That extreme example, you know, there's a lot of people out there that are extreme example that are examples of self-will run riot. You know, when you think about it, a fight is kind of fun to watch, you know. I mean, I love the story about the Irishman that's walking along and there's a fight in front of a bar and he goes, is this a private fight or can anybody join in? You know, I mean. But in a riot, there's no safe place to stand. You know, I mean, a brick can come flying out of anywhere. You know, I mean, self-will run riot, right? Now, imagine, I need to do a little graphic. Let's say this area right here, these shelves and this are, we're going to make that a graph, and that's going to be the entire population of the United States, okay? All of this is everybody in the country. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to go out there and we're going to get everybody that is self-will run riot, right? And we're going to build a little chain link fence area over here. And we're going to take all the people that are self-will run riot and we're going to move them into that fenced in area, okay? Now, we're going to go into this fenced in area and we're going to pluck out the extreme examples. The ones that the other people that are self-will run riot are going, oh, this brother here. We're going to pluck out all the extreme examples from this community. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the thing about it, and the thing about it is because of this delusion, I don't even think I belong in the fence. You know? Much less an extreme example. When you come to pluck me out, I think you've recognized your mistake. And that I don't belong with the people that are self-aware. Much less an extreme example. You know? So, I mean, that's what we're talking about. And it says, above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. I'll never forget it. Mark would look you dead in the eye and go, what does above everything mean to you? Isn't it interesting that it doesn't say above everything I got to stop drinking vodka? It says, above everything, I got to get rid of the selfishness. We muster, it kills us. God makes that possible. See, we can't have this conversation where I go, by God, you know that guy from Texas was right. I am just going to be less selfish. I'm not going to be like that. I'm going to start listening to people, and I'm going to start, you know, thinking about it. I can't do it on my own. It's in my DNA. That selfish reaction, and we could talk on and on and on about how self manifests in a guy like me. But my reaction, our reaction to situations in life, shock Al-Anons. You know, I mean, you know, when you know, we give our take on something, they go, you know, and the drunks are going, oh yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, I mean, it says. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we couldn't live up to them even though we would have liked to. Neither could I reduce my self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on my own power. I had to have God's help. This is being, now that is the end of what we mean. So remember when it said, just what do we mean by that? And what now up to there, they've been talking about what we mean, and they're about to switch into what do we do? And it says, this is the how and why of it. This is what I call the deal in step three. It says, first of all, we had to quit playing God. Why would I want to quit playing God? You know, what's the next three words? Somebody got your book open.
It didn't work.
If you playing God, you running the whole show, you know, is working out real good, rock on. You know, we got nothing for you. You know, but it says, if you're having a little trouble, if you're feeling those bedevilments, it says, we got to quit playing God. How do I play God? Well, one of the ways I play God is I know how everything needs to go. I know how everybody needs to act. I know how much money I should have. I know what kind of job I should have. I know who should be in my life and who shouldn't be in my life. I know how long people should live. I know how long I should live. I know who, you know, I know which job I should get. I know everything. Now, even though I don't have a long track record of making brilliant choices in my life, and I've got a lot of examples of where I didn't get what I wanted and everything turned out great, and I've got situations where I got what I wanted and it was awful. Setting that aside, I still know how everything needs to go, right? If you just ask me, you know. Now, the rules may change from yesterday till today, and I'm not going to issue a memo telling you that we're on a different basis. But I know how everything needs to go. That's how I play God, one of the ways. And it says, next, we decided. I used to think the third step decision was in the third step prayer. It's over here at the bottom, page 62. And it says, next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God's going to be our director. Now this little play has got a director. He is the father. We are his children. He is the principal. We are his agents. The principal is the head of the company. An agent is somebody that's been empowered to act upon their behalf. But it gives me three examples of that. Of now, you know, I've got this, there's a whole lot of things. That what I say the deal is in step three is that I am no longer in management. There's just a whole bunch of stuff in my life that is management level stuff. And I'm no longer in management. You know, it's above my pay grade. You know, how a whole bunch of things are going to go. And it says, most good ideas are simple. And this concept, what concept? The concept that God's in charge, or that I'm no longer in management. And it says, this concept was the new and triumphant arch through which we, was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. If you look at an arch, it's got a keystone at the top, and it's shaped different from all the other ones, and it's the thing that holds the whole thing together. And it's saying that the keystone of my arch through which I'm going to pass to freedom is that I'm no longer in management. This concept that I'm going to quit playing God. And it goes on and it says, when we sincerely took such a position, what position? That God's in charge and that suits me just fine. All sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Now, back on page 46, it says, we find that God doesn't make too hard terms for those that seek him. Well, here's the terms. It says, we had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provides what I need under two conditions. Stay close to him, perform his work well. It's telling me that's the deal. Those are the terms of the deal. God will provide what I need if I stay close to him and perform his work well. It seems like if I stay close to him and perform his work well, he's going to provide. All I can tell you is I've been all in on this deal for about the last 10 years, and God's been doing a kick-ass job of holding up his end of the deal. It seems like if I stay close to him and help his kids, you know, work with drunks. I used to, you know, always be worried about money. Now it seems like I spend half my time working with drunks, and I'm in the best relationship I've ever been in. I'm happier than I've ever been. My business is better than it's ever been. Everything, you know, it seems like there might be something to it. You know, it could just be a coincidence, but I'm in, you know. And it says, established on such a footing. There it is again, you know, basis, fundamental principle, footing. I become less and less interested in myself. More and more I become interested in what I can contribute to life. Give, give, give. As I feel new power flow in, as I enjoy peace of mind, as I discover that I can face life successfully, as I become conscious of his presence. That's another one of the words that I've been working with a lot out of the book, is basis, consciousness, and principles. Those three words will keep you real busy looking for them in the book, and we'll talk about some of them. But this consciousness of his presence, it says, as we became conscious of his, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter we were reborn. It seems to me like the book is not trying to take me to a belief in God or a faith in this power so much as a consciousness of this power. It's constantly trying to take it to where God is part of my world, where it's part of my thinking, part of my reaction to things. We do a lot of exercises at the table that we call current agnosticism. You know, I'll get the guys together and we'll all write down the three problems that we have and what are areas of your life that you're not bringing God into, you know. And it's unbelievable the way it shows up, because I don't know that what happens for a guy like me is you let me get out here and operate for a while, and what happens over a period of time, because self-will is my default position. And what happens is I don't even know it, but God's will starts dropping down and self-will starts rising up, and before I know it, God is not even a part of the equation. You know, I got this. And in the big book, the 12 and 12 talks about how we can have faith in God and still keep him blocked out of our lives. And the way that shows up for a guy like me is I'm going, oh, man, you know, God is awesome. Right? I mean, God, he took away the drinking. He took away the dope. God is fantastic. You know, I mean, I don't need him for this deal with Katie, you know. Or I don't need him at work, you know. I don't need him for this thing with my kids, you know. But if I ever hit a real problem, I'll bring God right in. But, you know, but in the meantime, take a knee. God, I got this, you know. It happens over and over, and you know, and when I really get it going on, have you ever felt this feeling where you got a serious problem, and then somebody tells you something like, "Well, turn it over," or "Have you prayed about it?" or "Have you written?" And I'm like, "Don't give me that AA shit right now." You know, this is a serious problem. You know. That's what I'm talking about. You know, self-will is rising. And the book is constantly trying to take me to a consciousness of this power. And it's all over the place. You know, it says it back on about, is it 51? You know, it's one of my favorite examples of the set-aside prayer. For years, I'd read this thing about people of faith. And it talks about leaving aside the drink question. They tell why living was so unsatisfactory. They show how the change came over. And I used to read this. Like I said, I like to read 2 pages a day out of the big book. Do the set-aside prayer, read 2 pages. If you read 2 pages a day out of the big book, you'll read the first 164 pages 4 times in the course of a year. Most of us would be better off if we read the big book 4 times a year. You know, I'd like to tell you I do it every single day, but I miss them. But this morning I do the set-aside prayer, and I was sure that for years that this book, I know in the third edition, it said, when many hundreds of people are able to say that the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives, they offer a powerful reason why I want to have faith. I was sure that's what it said. One day I do the set-aside prayer, and I read this, and it says, when many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives. I remember reading that and going, that is way different. You know? It says the consciousness of the presence of God. God's been there the whole time. It's not like when I did my third step, God picked his game up a little bit. You know? It's just that I finally joined in, you know. It says the consciousness of his presence is the most important fact of these people's lives today. There's a lot of places it says, it says the consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. We become conscious of his presence. It sought to improve our conscious contact with God. You know, throughout the book, it's trying to take me to a consciousness of this power. This is what, when I was talking to my buddy Bob earlier, when it says, what do we mean and what do we do? It spent those two pages talking about what we mean, and then it rolls into what we do. Look at the body of work that I missed when I went right from see that God could and what if we saw it to the third step prayer. Because now we roll into the third step. You know, it's funny. On page 60, it says we are now at step 3, being commenced. And on page 63, it says we are now at step 3. I think they knew that on page 60, I didn't have the information to be convinced that my life run on self-will could hardly be a success. Because it's interesting. On page 60, it says the first requirement is that I be convinced. On page 64, when we start this fourth step, it says being convinced that self manifested various ways was what had defeated us. We considered its common manifestations. So if on 60, the first requirement is that I be convinced, and over on 64, it says that being convinced, the information in pages 60 to 64 are put there to convince me that my life run on self-will can hardly be a success. So now when we roll into the third step prayer, it's got some meat on the bone. But all it is an affirmation of the decision I made on the page before. But now, because the first time I did the third step prayer, I'm feeling really awkward. I'm down on my knees with a grown man, and we're praying, and it just sounded like a bunch of churchy talk when we were doing it, you know. And now it says, God, I offer myself to you to build with me and do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Why? So I can have it a little easier? It says, no, so I can better do your will. Take away my difficulties. Why? So I can chill and watch the Cowboys game and the Lazy Boy? It says, no, that victory over them would bear witness to those I would help, of your power, your love, your way of life. This whole thing is about helping other people. The whole thing, you know, it drives me crazy when I hear people say, well, you know, this is a selfish program. And you're like, really? Find that for me in the book. You know, throughout the book, it's got stuff like our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depends upon our constant thought of others and how we can help make their needs. Katie likes it when I say my constant thought of Katie and how I can help meet her needs. But it's all about, you know, and then it says, take away my difficulties that victory over them would bear witness to those I would help of your power, your love, and your way of life. May I do your will always. I can't tell you how many times I've sat there and broken this stuff down. We break down step one and we break down step three, and then we get down on our knees and did it in Bermuda. Last Saturday, sitting by the water with this guy that had started the day off thinking he was on step four. And we spent 4 hours talking about this stuff. And he's like, man, I have never heard any of this stuff before. So now when we do the third step prayer, on our knees, he did the third step prayer. I did the third step prayer after him. And I think I probably felt it more than he did. Because now when I'm saying, relieve me of the bondage of self, I know what it's talking about. you know, take away my difficulties, because the next thing you know, I'm telling a new guy how to get through a divorce as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, or how to stay in a marriage as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Whatever it comes up, you know, this stuff, you find yourself, it's a problem one day, and you're helping somebody to solution the next day. We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. So this was only a beginning, though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. This body of work in 60 to 63 has got so much power, and I missed it for a long time. This is where we live with my sponsees now. I mean, when they're calling me, we are constantly going to page 60 to 63. You know, 10th step call, I'm like, let me guess, the show didn't come off very well. You know, they're not acting right. You know, our problems are about, you know, and so I've got to have in my life, I've got to have a sponsor that's taken me back to where did you set the ball rolling? How did you make decisions based on self? What's your role in this? Are you willing to look at it from an entirely different angle? Because if I got a sponsor where I'm calling him to bitch about Katie and he starts talking about Katie, I'm dead. I can't have a sponsor that's going, I already told you I couldn't put up with that shit for, you know, I mean, I'll get this much sympathy, and then we go right back to pages 60 to 63. And so we're going to talk about this, and it's time for lunch. It's time for lunch. I'll talk about the rest of this after the break. Thanks, guys. Yeah. Uh-huh.